In the complex world of cybersecurity, a significant conflict is unfolding with Russia, Ukraine, China, and Taiwan at its forefront. And it becomes even more complex as AI-based capabilities are layered into the dynamics. Amidst this technological chess game, a practical concern emerges. How does a nation maintain strategic asymmetric advantage without drowning in an overwhelming sea of data and alerts? Each year, IQT cyber experts select a focal point for research and strategic counsel for both investment endeavors and government counsel. The most recent findings cast a spotlight on the imperative task of scaling cyber defense capabilities. Rooted in the lessons drawn from Ukraine's remarkable success in fending off relentless Russian cyber aggression, this most recent exploration reveals the fabric of what constitutes effective cyber defense. Rather than just a suite of exquisite tools, a cadre of citizen cyber defenders, or critical open-source information, our experts found that the success behind this defense was due to organic public-private partnerships. Join us as we delve into the nuances of scaling these crucial capabilities. Welcome to the IQT Podcast. I'm your host, Vishal Sandasera, and today we'll explore scaling cyber defense. Joining me on today's show are two of my colleagues here at IQT, Grant Whiting and Dan Bochnek. Grant is a partner on IQT's investment team, focusing on cyber and enterprise technologies. He's responsible for identifying compelling startups that align with government partner needs and leading the commercial diligence and investment process. Prior to joining IQT, Grant worked at Bain & Company and was an intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. Grant is a graduate of Harvard Business School, the University of Cambridge, and Northwestern University. Grant, thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thanks, Michelle.
Dan is a technology architect in IQT cyber practice, focusing on the themes of threat intelligence, scalable cyber solutions, and applied AI. He is responsible for understanding the technical needs of IQT's partners and identifying and applying solutions from the startup ecosystem to help address those gaps. Previously, Dan worked at the MITRE Corporation as a principal applied cybersecurity engineer. Dan, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So let's get started with sort of the over-the-top, you know, view from the top question. Grant, maybe we'll start with your thoughts on why is this topic important now?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's sort of two answers to that question. One is sort of idiosyncratic to some of the research that Dan and I were doing last year, specifically looking at how successful Ukraine was in defending themselves from cyber attacks during sort of the full-scale invasion of Russia. And one of the things we sort of assumed we'd find and were looking for is, okay, what was the novel toolkit of things that we saw occur and were used successfully to help Ukraine defend themselves against Russia? And what we found, speaking to lots of organizations associated with, you know, supporting Ukrainian government, critical infrastructure, and et cetera, is that there was this incredibly robust coalition of some of the largest cyber vendors in the world who had been working with Ukrainian government and other critical infrastructure owners for a decade at that point, right? Far in advance of the full-scale conflict. And one of the things as part of that conversation we discovered is, you know, the likelihood that that same perfect storm, that same coalition would occur again when we think about other conflicts is not necessarily so. We may not see that same coalition for a whole host of reasons. And so one of the things Dan and I started thinking about was, well, what would you need to do to, in the aggregate, help replace that sort of capability? What could our government partners do to help understand how you would continuously identify vulnerability on networks you don't own at scale in a prioritized manner in a Taiwan, for example, or even in smaller conflicts like we saw in Albania or Costa Rica? Like, what would that look like? And what we sort of came to was this architecture around, this is a massive, massive data problem, right? It's a post-human data problem to help to do that at scale. And this sort of conversation that Dan and I were having was simultaneously we were having these conversations with other government partners who have these massive overwatch missions, right? The defense industrial base, critical infrastructure, a whole host of requirements. And also at the same time, you know, a lot of the innovations we saw in AI, they really, really rely on being able to have a modern data infrastructure in place to take advantage of those innovations. And so these sort of three different facets, these three different conversations we're having, all kind of came together to understand, well, if we had to put together an architecture to understand how you would need to do this at scale, both for future conflicts, which is sort of where this thing started, but also for enterprises and our government partners who have overwatch missions, how would you thinking about doing that, right? And so this is, you know, I think there's a lot of tailwinds that created this conversation and why we think it's really important right now. And there was also some just research we were doing that led us here to see all these things sort of compounding and coming together at the same time.
That's interesting. Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, yeah. And I think Grant hit all the wavetops correctly and really well. What we came up with is this architecture that he mentioned, and it's really got three different tiers. We're talking about the data collection domain, the data management domain, and the data dissemination domain. And these, you know, you kind of look at this as like a traditional security operations center workflow. It even mirrors like an intelligence lifecycle. But when you start to understand it in the cyber context, what we found was a few nuances that make this unique for scaling cyber and securing infrastructure you don't own. Notably, you need to have a very robust understanding of what your threat posture is, and that is enabled through some of these external threat telemetry companies and data feeds. Also, you need a really strong data management concept, and that is something that we've seen is pretty unique, and we can talk into that in a moment. But I want to also highlight the dissemination domain. So understanding that when this information is shared, it is actionable at scale in an automated fashion, such that the remediators can kind of proactively and even in an automated fashion defend their networks and apply these patches and understand insight into their network that they wouldn't necessarily have otherwise.
Dan, in your research, you uncovered, actually both of you uncovered a phrase that I found to be very interesting, which is sort of the maintenance of an asymmetric advantage. When thinking about scaling cyber capabilities, your thoughts on just what does an asymmetric advantage look like? How is it different than, say, you know, any other asymmetric advantage in another domain when it comes to cyber?
Right, yeah. So there's a million ways you can kind of parse this and look at this. One helpful framework is borrowing kind of an adversarial approach from the military and kinetic warfare, is finding that asymmetric advantage, which, you know, kind of refers to the a sort of capability that the adversary cannot defend against or does not expect. And when you apply that in the cyber realm, what you're really talking about is finding exploits that an adversary doesn't think exists or doesn't even know exists on assets. Maybe the adversary doesn't even know they have, and exploiting those and finding these vulnerabilities and exploiting them. And when we're talking about scaling cyber for defense, what we're really referring to here is the ability to coalesce all of these different disparate data feeds, disparate organizations, public-private partnerships to enable scalable defense. And that is something that we believe and we think in our view, we don't see currently occurring at scale. It's occurring in pockets and certainly mission organizations around the United States and other countries even have pockets of this. But when we're talking about what would confound an adversary the most, robust sharing of quality intel and being able to action that in automation at scale is something that would probably throw an adversary off in the cyber realm.
That makes sense. Grant, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Dan said. I think, you know, one of the things I would say is, cyber is such a cat and mouse game. There's constantly this question of, like, is this going to favor the defender? Is it favoring the attacker? Usually, I think, favors the attacker, typically. But there is new capabilities that enable, you know, that the adversary might not see coming, that, you know, et cetera. There's also just the fundamental value of speed, like how you can get that flywheel faster, right? Folks who understand like the OODA loop, like how do I observe, orient, you know, decide and act, right? How do I do that quicker and quicker and quicker than the enemy does? And that is fundamentally only enabled, I think, at this point with the amount of data you get, you have available as a cyber defender or an offensive actor by automation and potentially the use of AI. All of that is only going to be possible if you have the data resources in place. You've got your data cataloging and your data monitoring and your governance and that data pipeline that is enabling you to do all of these things faster. And one of the fundamental problems in cyber has kind of been a laggard when it comes to modern data infrastructure relative to many, many other disciplines.
Are there any lessons learned from other disciplines, as you so mentioned, that would be useful to perhaps adopt or consider within the cyber realm when it comes to at least data standards? And of course, let me just put an asterisk and suggest that any conversation about AI would be remiss if we didn't make mention of the trope, you know, good data in, good data out.
Yes, 100%, right? And like, and think about that. Like, how are you defining good data if you don't have a good understanding of your data catalog, if you don't have a good understanding of how this data can be enriched by other data sources at your disposal, and really being able to put all that data in a place where you can, hopefully in an automated fashion, surface insights that are valuable and potentially even insights that, you know, you wouldn't have queried for to begin with, right? This is one of the power of sort of the innovation of some of these AI solutions, right? It will find things that you wouldn't even have thought to find or a human would not have been able to find, not only just because of the scale, but also just the way it would have done its investigation. But I think one of the issues here is just many other disciplines, I think, do not have some of the drawbacks that we've seen historically when it comes to cyber data, right? Like most of the way we consume cyber data is these vertically integrated capabilities to do the collection, the analysis, and the give me an answer sort of thing, right? And all of this data has historically sit in silos, or you've taken all of your logs and you've thrown it into like a legacy SIM. And like, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of use cases where that can be really valuable. And we have a lot of people who spend a lot of money on that and trained on that. But if you wanted to disaggregate this collection, this data management, and sort of the insights that you're basically trying to surface from this, it's a kind of a different paradigm that lots of other places, like lots of other disciplines do. I mean, think about like all the ways that we deal with business intelligence that have revenue impacts on it, right? I think there's a lot more thinking on that than we've seen in cyber. And honestly, part of this is there are historical commercial disincentives to enabling data sharing. Right? I want you to live in my platform. I want you to be in my pane of glass, not the other guy's pane of glass. It's expensive to egress at times, right? There's a lot of inertia that exists in cyber that's made this hard, but I think that is starting to change. And I think partially because as more of your data, this all this crazy heterogeneous data is not just those logs that would live in a SIM. Well, I now want to do more with it. I've got data science on the team, and they want to do stuff with it, and they're bringing tools they want to do with it. And so I think we're starting to see this pressure to say, well, there is more that we can do, and there's these outside pressures saying we actually need to do a lot more because the adversary is getting faster, and if we're going to get as fast as they are, we need to set up the data in a way where we can get that, you know, flywheel spinning faster.
That makes a lot of sense. Dan, you know, we've sort of painted a picture of where we'd hope to be in the world when it comes to scaling cyber capabilities. What are some of the fundamentals that need to exist in order to sort of achieve some of the ideals that Grant is alluding towards? You know, when we think about the momentum and what makes this better, it sounds to me that there should be undeniable truths that that exist at the foundation. What are your thoughts on what those undeniable truths are?
So first of all, we understand that in this context, you have no insight into your IT, into the IT ecosystem that you're trying to secure. That is different than how it's traditionally run. But what that means is that you're not pulling endpoint detection telemetry. You're not pulling from firewalls. You're not understanding what threats you're necessarily facing from the inside of your IT network. So instead, we have to rely on external data feeds and external threat intelligence. And there's a broad span of really interesting companies and capabilities out there that are exploring the space here. And if you think of illuminating C2 infrastructure from the outside, passive DNS, understanding what is out there in the dark web and cataloging, triaging that such that it is searchable and actionable by a defender, all of those are really interesting data feeds that one can use from a cyber threat perspective. We're also looking at different applications of, as Grant mentioned, some of the data management technology, and one of them is the data mesh framework. So in this, you know, rather than using data lakes like Grant mentioned, you can use this data mesh concept, which is a shared computational governance structure where the data product is not just a raw piece, a raw feed of data, but it's actually a shared product between the consumer, the data consumer, and the data producer. And in that way, we're building in more of that schema mapping and auto parsing and cataloging and triaging such that when that data is shared to the end user, they're able to action it enable that flywheel that Grant mentioned, and enable that automation in a way that helps remediate in the end.
I see. Your thoughts, Grant?
I mean, I entirely agree with that. I think one of the things I would add, and one of the things we think about a lot at InQtel is, you know, the framework or the construct that Dan was just talking about, right? When we think about applying scaled cyber in future conflicts, right? We don't own the networks we're on. The telemetry and what we're trying to infer and back into to understand what's the worst threats that we need to ensure get fixed fastest on the pieces of critical infrastructure that we care about the most. That's a ton of data to get to that position, but it exists, right? It's just we don't have a great job in managing it. And so one of the things we think about InQtel a lot is that use case I just outlined and this sort of for future conflicts. This is very much something that like we talk to our government partners about, whether it's this, you know, supporting a Taiwan or Albania or Costa Rica or Ukraine, right, on one side, but also all these Overwatch missions I mentioned previously. what we try to do is, okay, what are we seeing on the in the commercial realm? And what innovative startups are we seeing that can help enable that use case relative to the enterprise use cases that they may be immediately addressing, right? To get ARR this quarter and grow as a company and all the stuff you actually need to do as a startup or even a large commercial vendor. And so one of the things I think that when we talk about this is we are, I think, starting to see that enterprise pull for disaggregating this sort of vertically integrated stack into this, you know, architecture overview that Dan talked about, right? The collection, the data management, the dissemination, right? We're starting to see some of that disaggregation, right? You see the large data lake providers like the Databricks and the Snowflakes and AWS all having security data lakes, individual security data lakes, startups, lots of companies doing the ETL step. Like, how do I abstract away all this heterogeneity so that you don't really need to care about that? We will make it into a place where you can use it once it gets there. And because we're starting to see some of that, one of the things I think we think about a lot is, okay, how can we use this relative to how the enterprise is using it, where they, by the way, do have access to their own internal networks, right? But take the meta capabilities out of that and churn it and apply it to this different use case where I don't see inside of the network, but need to automatically get a sense of, at the very least, what is, you know, where it is, what it is, like,
do I own it?
Yeah, is it on my surface? Like, is it on a surface I care about? Is this an energy utility or financial services or a telco? Or is it like a mom and pop pizza shop, which I don't really care about? Those are things that are really important to automatically get to quickly know. Because at the end of the day, I think for the use case we're talking about, what you want to be able to do is say, here are the things that definitely are exposed, likely have been owned. They're talking to C2.
They're critical to my stack.
Exactly. They're 100% critical. They're on critical infrastructure from like a national security perspective. Like, automatically knowing that for an entire country is kind of this provocative thing we're getting to. But InQtel, like, our authoritative position on this is, okay, but what are the technologies we're seeing commercially that we can take and leverage towards that mission to enable our ability to do that in the future and for future conflicts?
That makes sense. And you both spent a lot of time in your research sort of studying, as a case study, Russia and Ukraine. And you came across, I think, a very salient point, which is simply that years and years of public-private partnership amongst big vendors, cloud providers, you know, et cetera, Ukraine was able to sort of show up to the conflict with a better posture, say, than they would have without the sort of cooperation, without the participation and collaboration with these outside entities. And I think the tenet of our discussion today talks about, like, wow, that's a fragile thing to try to scale. Like, you know, you can't necessarily count on that happening all the time. But if we are thinking about this from the perspective of a paradigm shift, like, let's think about, like, hey, let's use this as an opportunity to think about things very differently. If we're going to, you know, do away with the philosophy of sort of cyber capabilities as we know them now, what are some of the things you think you ought to break apart? What are some of the thought processes or perspectives that ought to be broken apart and rethought? And maybe we'll take your thoughts on that first, Dan, and then we'll move to Grant after that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's like we said earlier, there's a lot of places that are doing this in bits and pieces. Like, yes, there are places, and of course, the national security strategy being released. You look at Estonia's third release of their third revelation of their revision of the national security strategy for them, and that is something that, you know, is pretty compelling, right? When you think about it, and you look at what are the options that one could kind of pursue from like a national perspective, and you know, we're thinking like national certs, national level SOCs that have the ability to integrate and munch through all of this data and kind of have the authorities and position to make sense of it.
Makes sense. Grant, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the other things that's really interesting, just from like a paradigm perspective, like how you think about this problem is, you know, on one side, what me and Dan are kind of talking about is like finding bad stuff and blocking, segmenting, getting it off the internet, like all of these things that just you're reducing your attack surface, basically, right? And for things that may have already been, you know, owned, like you are you're remediating, right, as quickly as possible. On the other side of the spectrum, there is all this work about how do we secure by design from the outset, right? How do we make sure that what we're building is actually not so easily owned to begin with, right? And so I think one of the ways we think about it is like that is super important, right? That we are trying to make these things more resilient from the outset. And I think what me and Dan are talking about is like while we're getting better at that, right? And the life cycle of those things and like things come offline and we churn over what's deployed and how secure it is. One, that is never going to be a 100% solution. We're never going to, you know, design everything to be 100% secure. It's just, it's always going to be asymptotic, at least at some point. But we're trying to like squeeze the balloon on both ends to some degree, right? How do we just get this flywheel so fast that max exploitation just doesn't have an asymmetric capability for the adversary, right, anymore, while we are simultaneously shoring up how resilient the systems we do deploy are, so that we're basically just closing the gap from both ends of the spectrum as fast as possible.
Makes sense. And for our listeners, the secure by design philosophy is predicated upon sort of thinking through how something at the outset is going to be impervious or sort of rock solid, you know, hardened against any and all attack. And for our listeners' benefit and mine, perhaps, how does one even know that they're creating something that is secure by design if they don't necessarily understand the universe of vectors of attack that might exist in the future, let's just say, if we're thinking about this as a cat and mouse game?
Well, geez.
I mean, I will say one conversation that I've seen a lot online recently is like, I think Stanford CS students don't have to have a
security course. That's right.
And like maybe start teaching security to software developers, but that's not going to solve the problem. But like, it's a step in the right direction.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, one step right to that end is the SBOM movement, right? Understanding. You know, it's the nutrition label for software, right? Understanding what the heck is inside of whatever piece of software you're producing and what your dependencies are. Those are and you know, there's so many more implications up the stack that get revealed when you do that properly. And we can talk about graph analytics and higher order insights that you can pull out from all of this knowledge and understand, okay, if this package or dependency is owned, am I owned? Where's my risk? Where's my exposure on this? And you can't answer that unless you do this work up front. And that's this whole concept of shifting left. And, you know, it is a valiant effort. And like Grant said, though, this is a multi-pronged problem. So being able to address it from patching's not going to go away. And so we're trying to like focus on that while not excluding, you know, we certainly at IQT invest heavily into the shift left problem. But we're also looking at, you know, what are the near-term opportunities for us?
That's right. And I'm actually reminded of a piece of work that came out of IQT Labs. So shameless plug for IQT
Nice.
Labs.
Nice. Do it, Michelle.
You know, since I'm in the labs. Nutrition labels. You know, we work on sort of an open source philosophy, so we leverage and contribute a lot to the open source software community. And the nutrition label became important to us as we worked with partners in the USG that were very concerned about, you know, some of the models or some of the algorithms that we were releasing in the open source. Hey, what's...
Yeah, yeah. What is in this thing?
It's in this thing. And so the nutrition label became sort of part of our regular operations of like sort of indicating like here are the things that went into this. Here's when they were patched. Here are these things that have sort of been, you know, discontinued, stuff like that. So certainly it seems like it's an important part of the cyber capability as well.
Yeah, I would say, one piece on that, what I think is really interesting is there's this pattern you see in security at times, which is I lack total visibility. So first step, like, let me get visibility, right? And I feel like we saw this in OT. We see this with SBOMs. We see this with all of the threat intelligence and stuff we're selling today and all the internal telemetry we pull. And there's this first step, which is I don't even know what I have on my network. I don't even know what's in this software package. Like, I don't even know what I'm dealing with here, right? But that's always that first echelon problem. And then there's this next step, which is, awesome, I know exactly, I have an SBOM. What do I do with this now? Like,
yeah,
what is the next step
here,
right?
Yeah. I love that problem. Yeah. It's fun to think about, and it's really cool to see what the commercial market's doing with that
yes.
problem.
And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing, I think, across the board, if you, like this analogy I used of like squeezing the balloon. Like, I think in cyber, the idea is we're just trying to keep squeezing more bits of the balloon everywhere until we can just pop the thing and the enemy can't take advantage of it. I don't know.
I love
it. Fell apart pretty bad. But the point being, like, you know, we creep up on this stuff as we realize, like, I don't know what's on my OT network. I got to figure that out. Okay, now what do I do about it, right? And this is something that, like, I think is really exciting for us at InQtel is we get to look at the next generation of startups who are biting off that next piece of the problem set and saying like, yes, you've already got visibility, but let me show you what you can do with it, right? But the more and more we do that, the more and more data we have and the less and less we, you know, you got to solve that problem, right?
Yeah. I'm also reminded of, you know, the questions of related to what is on my network. The second question we often get is, well, what the heck is it doing? And how do I know if it's behaving properly or improperly? And that answer usually depends on a lot of factors. Yeah. Time of day, who's on the network, what other types of devices.
But and then you answer like, so what? And
yeah.
and that's where it comes back to this external telemetry feed of like understanding what's out there, understanding what exploits are being actively exploited in the wild and understanding what APTs, what, you know, persistent threats and what their tactics, techniques, and procedures are. And how you're defended against those. per industry or per company or right. per field.
Per application. Per, like, yeah, I, you know, like exactly. I found like this application is super vulnerable, but guess what? It's not business critical and I don't care, yeah. right? But a security team may have no idea if that application is right. business critical or not, right? In the same way we're like, this IP totally got owned, but it's on a mom and pop's pizza shop. So maybe I don't care about that. But like all of that is important for figuring out with the very, very little bit of resources at our disposal, right. what we actually need to go do first and fastest.
Which is why it's critical this data model build in that contextualization yes. to this data. So it's a lot of metadata. It's a lot of it's a lot of fields, right? And you can see this even in some of the schemas for both the government and open source are following is that there are fields for prioritization. There are fields for what is this and where does it exist in my ecosystem? So the local IT environments can fill those fields in and better prioritize all of these 9.8s, 9.7s.
Yeah, yeah. As we're approaching our time, I do want to address one other topic before we break, and you sort of dovetailed into that, Dan, real nicely, which is the role of the human being. So, you know, we've talked about paradigm shifts, we've talked about AI, we've talked about the overwhelming amount of data and information. Love your thoughts on what is the role of the human if you're as we're rethinking scaling cyber capabilities. We know what the human has done thus far with the network operator and a team of sort of cybersecurity forensics experts and analysts have done so far. What does their role look like as we go into the future? And Grant, we'll start with you first.
Yeah, the big thing for me is there are a lot of other disciplines that are going to be critical for doing this well going forward. Mainly, you need data scientists, you need engineers, you need folks that are just outside of the cyber analyst, and that can be a cyber analyst who's been upskilled to a data scientist or engineer. But we need to think about this not as a give a bunch of data to a cyber analyst and then let them go figure out what the problem is. You need data scientists who are part and parcel cross-functional capabilities with this. And like, this is hard. Like, it was funny. I was talking to someone not long ago who is a CISO, and I was asking him about like how much data science do you have, in the company. It's a large financial services firm. And they were like, well, we have some obviously, and they care about this and they're doing it well. They're like, but when I upskill a cyber analyst with a lot of data science, they leave and go get a data science job. So this is hard. And there's those people you need to bring. And then the other thing I think is those people want to bring the tools they know how to use to the problem. And this goes just back to this like siloed data issue is like, if you can't bring the tools you know how to use to help solve the problem because the data is not in a format that you can use, or it's siloed in this weird way, or it's got some weird query language you don't understand or whatever, it becomes really, really hard for that cross-functional team to be successful.
Yeah, and I'll just add that one of the things I kind of jokingly say and borrowed from a colleague is that there's not enough parking, right? Stop building parking lots, but stop building parking garages for your analysts, right? We have to figure out ways to solve this in a post-human world, and because everyone's drowning in data, so those parking spots need to be filled with yes, SOC analysts, but SOC analysts that understand that they need to build in some of this automation and look at where we can kind of cut corners but sort of end around the problem with the smart application of AI. So we're seeing SOC tasks being automated now, and in the marketplace there's companies that are working around this problem to be able to turn the crank on some of these rote tasks that soak up the majority of these analysts' time. And so I would say, like, be a part of the solution there.
Part of the problem.
Well, they're never part of the problem, but it's just like being proactive on it and saying like, yeah, let's try and figure out ways to automate myself out of a job.
Right.
That's noble.
Well, you know what, gentlemen, we're at time. If I had maybe 10 more seconds, I would, and I think I do, I would like to end with your thoughts on where our listeners can turn to for more information if they're interested with this topic. Maybe a book, a website, just a blog post. Any quick thoughts on that? I'll put a shameless – it's not really shameless since I didn't write this book at all, but Sandworm, I think at one point –
You didn't write that book?
I didn't write that book. But yeah. I'll tell you what, the author did come to – did host a talk at IQT. Yeah. So if he's out there listening, thank you for that. That was fun. That book was excellent. Talked a lot about sort of the zero-day exploits and learned a lot about sort of the cyber war, the cyber warfare tactics that were in use at the time, specifically with like Russia and Ukraine and whatnot, and others as well. So if anyone's interested, feel free to read that book. Any other resources that you'd call out?
I mean, one thing that we've asked our some portfolio companies, right, come to us and say, hey, we need up our game in cyber. your local FBI field office has that capability. We routinely refer them to some of those organizations.
I love that. You heard it here. Go talk to your local FBI branch. That's where to get the
maybe
most
send an email. Don't knock on their door.
Dan, Grant, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to today's episode of IQT Explains on the IQT podcast. Please make sure to subscribe to the IQT podcast so you don't miss out on future content, and leave us a review or a comment to let us know what you thought of today's discussion or any other discussions you think we ought to have in the future. I encourage you to check out our website at www.iqt.org to explore more content about cutting-edge technology to support and deliver insights and capabilities essential for national security mission impact. Thank you, and talk to you all next time.